Hello there. Welcome to the podcast. Imperial Security Bureau podcast is named after the NSA CIA in Star Wars, if you don't know. But we're not going to talk about Acolyte. Let's pretend that never happened. But today, we've got an awesome guest. His name is Joe Aurelia. He's in operations at Cyware. We're talking operational efficiency here and some other subjects, of course, AI, some recruiting, you know, the normal stuff. Let's check out his LinkedIn. Here he is, SVP of operations at Cyware, strategically tactical. I love that headline. Impact mindset, reality checker, GTM advisor. Let's talk about his background. He has a Bachelor of Science degree in computer science from Rutgers and an MBA from Stevens Institute. He started his career at AT&T. He was a senior technical associate, promoted to systems lead. Then he left there and went to IBM for 6 years, where he spent time being an IT specialist and an enterprise architect. From there, he established his own residential and commercial solar installation company to take advantage of a critical time in renewable energy. But in 2019, he came back into tech, where he's been the SVP of operations for Cyware, along with joining SIM, which is Society for Information Management, where he's a board member. He's also a board member of Pavilion as an executive member, and they are a global membership organization for high growth operators. And might be something you want to check out if you're an executive leader. But we talk operations, we talk recruiting. It's a fun conversation. If you want to find Joe, Joe's done quite a few podcasts recently. He's on YouTube. Check him out. I'm excited to chat with him. Here we go. Well, all right. Welcome to the podcast. Joe, how are you?
I'm doing well, Blake. Thank you for having me here. I'm very happy to be looking forward to this conversation.
Yeah, I'm excited to chat with you. We got a lot to cover today, especially talking about operations and operational efficiency. And Joe's been in the cybersecurity industry, so this is going to be fun. A couple warm-up questions. What's your favorite movie and what's your favorite band?
Ooh, I got to admit, I always go with Iron Man. Just I like them all. I think the earlier ones rather than the later ones kind of start with the beginning stage. So go Iron Man for the movie.
Kill power.
And band, I'm probably going to have to pick what I was listening to lately, and I'm probably going to go back with Fuel. So a little bit of an oldie but goodie, I suppose. And leave love bleeding
In my hands again. Fuel, yeah, Iron Man is my favorite also in the Marvel universe. And then Fuel, I used to listen to a lot of Fuel. Are they still around?
In my head, they are, so let's keep it like that.
Okay. I love some of their stuff. I used to listen to it a ton. Being a 90s kid, right? 90s alternative rock. Fuel is amazing.
It is. But then again, he's talking about coming around. I mean, Iron Man, I mean, he's kind of back alive as of this week. So that's big news.
Yeah. Did I hear he's going to be playing Dr. Doom? Right.
Yeah. That was inspirational right there. And now I got to see what happens.
Wait. So is Dr. Doom in the DC universe or in the Marvel universe?
That, I don't know, contractually wise, but I guess the next two Avengers that are coming up, I mean, he will be that character. So I didn't imagine that, and that should be really fun to watch.
It's going to be kind of strange, isn't it, to see him play two different characters in the same universe? I don't know. I don't think. I mean, I'm happy for him. So I love Robert Downey Jr. Anything he's one, yes. in is awesome. But like, it's going to be weird seeing him play Dr. Doom when it's like, wait a minute, wasn't this guy Iron Man?
I have to imagine they got some spicy things up their sleeves. Otherwise, why take the chance?
So they'll make it so we've shifted into the multiverse and wound up on a timeline where Iron Man doesn't exist. And instead, we get Dr. Doom. How else can you make sense of it?
You just ruined the anticipation I had for something that was going to occur 2 years from now, Blake. I mean, how could you do that to me?
I'm sorry. All right. So, a lot of folks will ask, tell us your story. And I do want to get into that. But I was asked this question the other day and it stopped me in my tracks. And it's become like my new favorite question. So here it is. If aliens came down to Earth and they brought you in a room and asked, who are you and what's your purpose here? How would you answer that?
I think survival would kick in at that point, and I would probably let them know that I've been waiting for them and I'm here to make their life happy. play the nice friendly card, you know?
Okay. All right. That's fair. I was in this discussion with Daniel Meisler. We were talking about AI, and I was like, as a recruiter, should I find a new profession? And he's like, man, I think we all should find a new profession. Like everybody. And he's like, but the question you should be asking yourself is like, what do you care about? What problems are you trying to solve? What's your purpose? And, you know, if aliens came down, and he asked me this question, and I'm like, man, that's deep right there, you know?
What was your answer?
He didn't make me, he was just riffing. He's like, this is the question you need to be thinking about. So I've been thinking about it the whole time. As a recruiter, I'm like, my mission is create win-win situations, and I'm trying to help hiring managers find the best talent to, you know, solve their business problems, and I'm trying to help land candidates a 15 to 20% raise, new career they're excited about, and I'm making connections, whatever. But at the same time, it's like, wait a minute, is that even a good answer? I don't know. It was just interesting. So tell us, man, go back, just give us the short, what's your story, if you don't mind.
Yeah, what's the story going there? I looked around and see a black couch. I didn't know what kind of interview this was going to be. For me, going back, I guess I've always been in businesses for a long time, right? My dad had his own company. He put me to work very, very young, but I enjoyed it. I loved spending the time with him and doing the activity. So I've kind of been in like a work atmosphere since I was five. If that sounds probably not legal, but I think it's okay. So, you know, getting to meet customers, having conversations, doing work, you know, seeing how money is transcribed and how you do sort of those billing transactions. So it's kind of been in there for a while. I have my own companies over time, you know, consulting, iPhone stuff, helping others with business and management things. Always love that. But then went into the official careers, you know, AT&T, IBM, you know, building large, you know, architectural systems for them and working through massive global teams and, you know, infrastructure migrations, all that kind of stuff. But the operational bug didn't come until later. It actually came by accident. I was creating another company. We grew that out. You know, we had a lot of success. We had a lot of different opportunities that we undertook. And when I was looking for that change to come back to technology, someone who I was having conversations with kind of like this said, oh, you're an operator. And I was like, well, what's an operator? Like the person who answers the phone? And they're like, no, you operate companies. And it's an interesting thing when they start talking about to understand how building companies and knowing how all those pieces go together and how you collaborate and how you build, you know, people, process, technology. I had a title. At that point, I didn't know I had a title. And the more I've talked with more folks in this industry, the more I learn that we've all kind of got here by accident, right? I mean, check your college list of degrees. Is there an operator degree? Is there an operations class? Is there a, you know, building a company 101 class? No. We all just kind of love the ability to have an impact, to constantly do something new every day, to keep changing, you know, the definition of our role, to see things kind of come to pass and kind of grow in front of you. And we all, you know, wind up on the side of the house eventually.
Yeah, I've always wondered if like the COO role, that role should be kind of reclassified to chief business architect, because it is like the business architect. You're architecting the processes that the business should follow to be efficient and to operate completely streamlined. So it's like you're an architect. Right.
It is, you know, in some ways, I mean, technically I was a software architect beforehand. So I think of that a little bit differently in terms of the creation of things. You know, to be honest, most people on the other side look at it in terms of the GSD kind of methodology, right? And at the end of the day, they call us because they want things to get done. They want things to be completed, whatever title you give it or whatever nomenclature the company happens to adorn to it. It's just the individual and group of individuals who are known for completing things, who can, you know, fill in the blank when there's a question mark, right? Here's this task. I don't know where it belongs. Is it sales? Is it finance? Is it CS? Is it marketing? We have no clue. It's clearly an operations thing, right? So just throw it into the bucket, have them figure it out, and, you know, come back with an answer.
Never a dull moment in your world then, I guess.
When there's dull moments, you start to get really concerned. Some might have panic attacks, not me, but you know, it's usually not dull in business, especially if you're growing and doing lots of things. There's not a lot of time for dull. Maybe during a holiday, perhaps, but other than that, not much dullness.
How'd you land in cybersecurity?
You know, to be honest, I was doing networking, having conversations. I was looking for a change at that point. And people, just you're talking to different folks, you're sharing what you do and what you want to do, and old-fashioned networking, very similar to recruiting, right? Someone comes to you with a particular role, you use your knowledge, your connections, your intimate understanding about what people are capable of, and you kind of just connect people together. So a little bit of some old-fashioned people skills.
Nice. I was listening to some of your other podcasts that you did recently, You guys are talking about RevOps, deal cycle management, operations, you know, what's going on in the contract space. You talked a lot about Salesforce. What trends are you seeing in terms of like deal cycle, deal flow in this market?
That's an interesting question. You know, I think it's something where a lot of individuals, a lot of companies, and I'm not trying to generalize, so to speak, though, but you get so involved in what you're doing that how often do you get to pop your head out of your company for a moment and say, hey, what's going on? Like, what does this look like? You know, am I in the right direction? Let's do a sniff test. Let's see how we're going. You know, you can have quarterly reviews. You can have, you know, meetings with your team and everything. But I think to truly remove yourself from the situation and say, hey, like, how is this company doing? How is that company doing? You know, what's going to happen out there? I think a lot of companies themselves don't spend the time to do that. But I think others external in the industry have been doing that, right? We're seeing a lot of conversation around, you know, revenue architecture, go-to-market motions, methodologies, you know, other types of collaboration activities, you know, the way SaaS is going in the future. I see that being different, right? I think we're going to transform from, hey, you know, this is a SaaS business. We are doing things to understanding more about the intimacies of the conversation, right? The true competitive nature of your product, the life cycle of the product, the way you are, you know, having the client relationship from the start to the end and how things just don't end after you sign the paper. I think the maturity of understanding how you kind of keep that connective thread going is something that's going to take some time to mature, but it's also going to be different, you know, for each business, right? If you look at a more generic SaaS service where there's, you know, 20 different options, right? You know, you really want to hold on to that customer and kind of keep them there because they have an easy ability to switch. So how are you maintaining features? How are you keeping up that conversation? Whereas if you have more of a bespoke SaaS product, you may not have the same competitive forces, but you still need to have a happy client, right? So how much effort are you putting into nurturing use cases, ensuring utilization levels are up and kind of monitoring that customer environment to ensure they're getting everything they expect and kind of building that partnership up in order to get more referrals and more white papers and everything else. So I think the care and diligence that goes into the entire life cycle will be increasing over time. And that won't initially result in an increase in profitability. But I think it's more of a longer play, right? You have to kind of look at it in terms of, hey, do I want to be here for 10 years? I want to be here for 5 years. And what will it take to get there?
That's a tough one right now. Everybody's trying to figure out, okay, what are we going to do with AI? Because how's this going to impact our business? And everybody's doing like an API integration with ChatGPT and saying, yeah, we're an AI company now. And it's like, okay, well, what does this mean? So is there anything, and we'll talk about AI, I promise. I'm going to give you plenty of time. But is there anything happening right now in terms of like new contract terms, wordsmithing of the terms, anything you're seeing?
Certainly. We procure a lot of software where we are today, right? We have, you know, I spoke about this beforehand, probably like 170, 180 different applications. So we're talking about seeing a lot of vendor agreements, you know, contracts, renewals. You know, there's some common trends in how people do these modifications. What I think is really pointing out is that when in the last, let's say, 5 or 10 years, has there been that much of a monumental shift in the potential of the way data flows through a SaaS system, responsibility of ownership, the liability, the way it can be reused, you know, in other systems later on, that hasn't occurred as of late, right? So we all probably got content in the way we do things, where we ship paper, the way we're having conversations. We're now as a world kind of waking up to, oh, this whole thing changed. How do we cover this? How do we cover that scenario? What do we do with data privacy? There's lots of different laws coming out. There's international considerations. So I think we are, to me, I think we're still at the nascent stage of a standardization around the nomenclature. You know, what is true AI? What is a true LLM? What are you actually doing? When do you have to notify? When do you not have to notify? How do you manage information? How do we get around common terms for the data relationship between the client and the product? I think we have a lot of road left to travel still on this one.
For sure. Everybody does. Well, so I just established my own recruiting agency here. So how are we going to get a contract approved with Cyware, my man? What's the process?
That's rather on the spot, Blake.
Hey, man, you got to use the opportunities we're given in life.
You know, you are talking to an operations person, so I don't like doing things twice. So I'd ask if you could kindly use our paper, since we already have a contractual agreement. If you sign our paper, it'd be a lot faster.
All right, well, I got to talk to my wife about that. So she's got to read over it, and she's like operating as my legal chief administration officer. So, and my daughter too, she's actually our CEO, but yeah, I'll get back to you. Send it over and we'll get back to you. What's your take on what's happening in cybersecurity lately? Is there anything that's kind of at the forefront of everybody's minds? Is it just AI?
You know, to me, it's an industry that is going to consistently see change, consolidation, you know, maturity. We're still very young, right? If you look around, you kind of go to a non-technical event and there's people there. You know, this isn't a word that's on people's minds, right? Yes, when it's an incident, when you see it on the news, you understand it. But as a society, everything in our lives is technology-based, right? And a lot of people live in this this blissful nature of assuming that, you know, those apps will always work tomorrow. You know, my connections will always be there. My phones will always be on. When the truth is, there's a whole army of companies and teams and agencies, you know, trying to consistently secure and protect this information so you can continue to live in that blissful state. I think there's still a lot of work to go through. I think it's been great strides, but I think the next, you know, 10, 20 years, obviously you can say AI, you can say maturity, you can say experience, you can say, you know, collaboration. I think we have to enter into a different state of awareness, a different state of ability to respond to events and to mitigate them quicker. If you look at obviously the incident, you know, of the last week or two, right? You know, it's such a phenomenal numbers game, the amount of people that could be impacted by a change, the amount of press that can be generated, the amount of labor that has to go into that. You know, as a society, you know, things that would have had a small ripple effect can now have a massive ocean wave, right? So how do you mitigate that? How do you, you know, have, you know, sort of almost a cultural BCP plan, so to speak, right? To roll back, to get to a status of maturity. It's a very interesting area. Lots of smart minds, you know, are on it, you know, trying to solve problems. And I think it would be an area that's ripe for improvement for a very, very long time.
Well, CrowdStrike gets picked on a lot, right? But you know what? As someone who's demoed and tested out a lot of software lately, none of them work right. So yeah, it's all broken. So we have empathy for you guys. You know, I know it was a big deal, but it's not easy to make software that works on every single device at all times, every version. You know what I mean?
It's incredibly complex. And certainly I don't, you know, not gonna, you know, pick against one name or the other, so to speak, you know, but you know, those of us who come from a technical background, right? You know, we understand implicitly the complications of testing, the number of variations of systems that are out there, the unique tendencies and tweaks and the variances of operating systems and the way that one does something over the other. The testing of these things is phenomenal. I guess if you want to go down that road, since you walk down that road, right, you have the whole Apple conversation, right? So, you know, what is the reason that we're so restricted on the device, so to speak, right? You have a one process, one standard. And the you know, the hearkening bell for ages has been because we can control the environment. There's a lot of truth to that, right? You know, yes, you are sort of buying into one ecosystem, but the environment is boxed. Like you kind of know what you get, right? So the rules are well defined. So you might say that you can have more flexibility in other places. You might be able to make your own tweaks, but your risk profile can also be reduced a little bit. So there's lots of ways to think about that situation.
Yeah, as an Android guy, I don't appreciate that at all.
I thought we have an opportunity to be friends. Then you pulled that one out. I mean, soon our bubbles can be the same color, but for now, I'm not sure how it's going to work out.
All right. That's fair. Yeah. Agree to disagree for now. So
I was wondering why you were sending me green messages beforehand. Now I should have understood.
Stupid green. Hey, and the argument that the Apple community has against Android is like, why are you so antiquated? But everyone's moved to like this new texting standard. It's just Apple that doesn't want to join up. It's like, I don't get it.
I can hear you. I mean, our RCS is not new. You know, if I want to go back to your testing line, you could say they just wanted to really make sure it worked.
Fair enough. You can't argue with that, especially in light of what happened. It's like, well, hey, text is never broken.
I will say though, I mean, as someone who has way too many, you know, applications in their life that they have to manage, you know, every time you have to check yet another app for a little red dot that someone wants to get in touch with you, it is a lot of work. You know, the ability to have that on your laptop, on your iPad, and to be in one circle and not to go anywhere else, there is certainly a lot of time saved from that conversation. So the minute we can all become friends and live within one place, I just look at it from the productivity savings is the chief benefit for me.
True. So you were the first US employee for Cyware and coming up on 5 years now. Congratulations.
Thank you. That time has gone fast.
Time flies when you're having fun, right? So they now have around like 300 employees or more. So, wow, it's an incredible story. Do you want to tell us a little bit kind of what makes Cyware different in the cybersecurity space?
I'll start, I think, from the, what makes it different from the growth part first, if I may. You know, when we had started, we started in the U.S., I started a little bit before COVID had come out. And when COVID happened and the world started to change, you know, the focus that we had on the people side was really how do you create a culture where people feel welcomed, knowing that they're never going to see you in person, right? It's kind of an odd request. Now we've obviously, this is kind of old hat. People have been going through this conversation now for a few years, but really focusing when you're growing a team, think about it like growing a seed, right? You put the seed into the pot, you try to press lightly with your fingers, you water it every few days, you try to nurture it and make sure it's safe, you put it in the right sun. People and companies are no different. You know, if you rush into things, you don't get the results you want. And I think what we focus on, especially heavily in the beginning, was how do you grow those people? How do you bring them together? How do you make that a strong structure? And then when you translate that to the cybersecurity aspect, you know, by enabling your people to be strong, by enabling people to work together, to collaborate, to have that communication, you know, up and down the stack, I think that's how you're able to do incredible things because you have people working together as a unit. And that's been an important, you know, sort of a mantra for me, right? If you look at some of the things I've said before, you know, the people process technology part, you can have the best process and the most awesome technology. But if you leave the people out of the equation, you're kind of dead on arrival, which is unfortunate. You know, we're all still here. AI is not going to, you know, off us anytime soon. So focusing on that, I think, leads to better products, better collaboration, better ability to serve the client, better ability to respond in times of incidents or fire situations. Those are kind of my thoughts.
Yeah, if you can get that right, that's incredible. And I was looking, so the U.S.-based office for Cyware is in Jersey City, right on the Hudson River. And pre-COVID, I was actually traveling up there. It was like every 5 or 6 weeks I'd go visit a client for like a couple days, client meetings. I kind of missed that. There's a big return to office mandate, and that's been happening for past year, year and a half. But if you can actually be really good at running a virtual, like 100% remote company, keeping people engaged, it's an art, it's a science. So if you can get it right, kudos to you. Any secret sauce?
Honesty is one, I think, you know, especially nowadays, you know, we all have access to more information. People are very skilled. You know, just be straight with your team. You know, if you have something complicated that you're going through, find a solution together, right? I like to operate in what I've always considered like a titleless society. I mean, many people on a call, many different titles, you know, many different departments. We're on the call to solve something, right? That's what we're focusing on. We're solving something. There's a problem, there's a situation, there's a growth activity. That's what I want to talk about today. I think that is a key differentiator to kind of making change, is to focusing on what's important. I do believe, though, the in-person things are incredibly vital. You know, of course, airplane tickets are expensive, hard to get people from many states together. But when you do, this certainly just sort of like a magic people energy that kind of occurs, right? You do tend to, I think, get a little bit more done when you're doing certain working sessions. There's a, you get to build up that rapport that is not impossible online, but it's certainly harder, right? So imagine, you know, we're in an office together. We go out for lunch a few times when you first join. Like, we're going to know a lot about each other, right? We're going to be able to kind of have some jokes, have some conversation, kind of understand how people respond. You know, what could have occurred and maybe, you know, 3 half-hour sessions might take you a few weeks over Zoom.
Very true. Yeah, people feel like they're on an island working remote. So it's good if you can do like at least like once a month or something, you know, once a month, once a quarter at worst.
Once a month, once a quarter, 30-something states. I mean, unless I could send you the expense bill, we'll have to see how we can make that happen.
I know, right? Yeah, it gets expensive. But you are saving money on office space. So... So Cyware, right? They've got an AI product and it looked pretty cool, right? Quarterback your cyber defense, and you can engage with your own LLM or existing LLMs, and it had pre-programmed responses like incident response. It's really well named, Quarterback Your Cyber Defense. Overall, I mean, we talk about AI a lot on this podcast, but are you like really optimistic about AI or pessimistic about AI in terms of just job creation?
It's a fair question. You did warn me in the beginning you're going to head down that road. So in fairness, I guess that's fine. I'm not worried about job creation, but I would go with the standard line of jobs changing, right? You know, I can't see entire professions being wiped out. I think that's not going to happen. I see the way work is performed being modified. I see things being quicker in some fashions, or maybe more prolific in others. But think of it this way, go back a little bit more generic in terms of the analysis, giving someone a laptop versus a desktop, right? Able to do things more mobile, bring work home, work in different environments. And you say, okay, instead of a laptop, I give you a cell phone, do work even more places. We've constantly been enabling people to do more. You know, you had an older email type program, then you had more modern email type programs. You had Slack, you had communication, you know, you had a Rolodex, now you have Salesforce. We've constantly been enhancing people's ability to be productive, the way you work, the productivity of work. That's constantly been being modified over the, you know, the course of time. AI is certainly a level up, right? You're having this much larger sort of like second brain that you can ask questions to. And that certainly is going to facilitate things to be quicker. But are we at the point yet where we're relying on it 100% to make all of our decisions for us, you know, to run a company, to collaborate and make people work together? No, but can we use it to do things faster? Can we use it to write memos or analyze data or do research for us? Yes. So ideally, you know, again, maybe not for all roles, but if you can offset the, I won't say busy work, but the work that takes you more time to do that maybe really isn't thoroughly enjoying to you, and you spend the making up of the time on the actual people conversations, meeting your clients, having conversations, having QBRs, working with your team, collaborating, brainstorming, architecting, that would be a net win, you know, for companies, right? Because you're spending more time doing the activities that a true human can only do, and that cannot be outsourced yet to some other, you know, being or entity or whatever it happens to be. So I would hope to see that occur. I think some positions, you know, obviously are more at risk than others, but that does give an opportunity, hopefully, for folks to move into those higher positions and then be able to gain and participate even more.
Yeah, I agree that there's a lot of fear that AI is going to replace people. And I don't know. I just think there's going to be a resistance, especially some of the tools that I've tried out, like an AI interviewer versus me doing it. Why don't I just let the AI do it? I found that people have been very resistant to even participating in it. Like they just don't want to do it. It's like calling in to customer service whenever you have a problem and you're just like trying to hit 0000 to get to a person. It's like, I don't want to deal with this AI. Like people want to deal with people. And that, I don't think that's going to change.
I'm going to be a little different on that, I think. So I agree in certain things. I think it makes entire sense. But if you think about, let's say, ordering food, for argument's sake, right? Would you prefer to make your super complicated coffee order on an app or have to wait in line and then try to reiterate this very complicated thing of syrups and sugars and mixes? I mean, in those kind of instances, the technology really does enhance your ability to get things done faster. You know, what is the value of you spending a minute to explain something, someone spending a minute to consume that, then document it into the register and then serve the order? So in those ways, I think that the automation is really useful for us. But for the, you know, getting people to buy in, have conversations, you know, make a complex purchasing or collaborate or make things that are truly impactful and new, then yes, I entirely agree with you. That people-to-people aspect really is a differentiator. You know, if I want to buy a product and it's just a cold touch with an AI versus I could talk with someone and I feel they actually care and they're going to be there, they want to service it, it's a different experience. Similar to buying a car, right? You can buy the same car from multiple places. The individual who kind of makes you feel warm and fuzzy, you might even be willing to pay more for that car simply because the experience didn't make you feel negative.
You got a point there. As the AI gets really smart, right? And they give you compliments and they say things that kind of make you feel, wait a minute, is this thing real? If you can't tell the difference and you get a better experience, then yeah, AI is going to win every time. So it's probably going to get to that point. And then we're all kind of doomed. So separating ourselves from the AI conversation here, there's another topic that I wanted to bring up. And I got to chuckle. So I was looking at Cyware, right? And it's a threat intelligence platform, right? TIP. It's a threat intelligence ecosystem. So TIE, there's something on the website. And I need to familiarize myself with this. Maybe you can help us understand. But it's a ISAO and ISAC. These are acronyms. And then there's also, it's a SOAR platform, competitor to Splunk. And then I also was on a podcast the other day, someone mentioned another acronym, CTEM, Continuous Threat Exposure Management. Who's making up all these acronyms, man? I mean, who's making all these up? Is this just a marketing play to try to be different? Like,
I mean,
Where are these coming from?
You're asking the wrong person. I mean, I started in telco, right? So for us, like, you know, when you started in your first week, they gave you like a book. It was 400 pages. That here's the acronyms you expect to learn. So my life has always been acronyms. I don't think people are making up acronyms, so to speak, though, but it's just how things can be more easily communicated, right? But it is very esoteric. I had a gentleman ask me a few weeks ago, and like, well, how do I know if someone needs, you know, this product? And when you get to that level of complexity, it's almost like, well, you kind of know if you need it or you don't need it, right? Like you know if you need to buy a car, you're going to ride a bicycle for this week. The acronyms kind of help to kind of make the conversation thing a little bit simpler, but it is something to get used to. There's many ways to explain it, to converse about it. It's a technical kind of thing, so I'm very used to the whole acronym soup. There are so many different things that need to occur in your cybersecurity landscape, that there can be so many companies that could sound similar, but could be doing very different activities, and they all focus on a different part of the stack. And then as we all mature as businesses, you know, you see consolidation and what is important now, or what has changed, or what can be, you know, more useful for teams. We understand the integration between the actual tooling and your teams, or the management expectations, or the risk environment, or your compliance landscape. But yeah, I mean, I think there'll be acronyms forever. But yeah, you have me thinking here. I'm thinking about something like, I guess was, I don't know if it has an acronym, but you know, when you're using an app, you have like the three little lines that you click to kind of get something down like a menu. I'm pretty sure that's actually called a hamburger, because the three lines look like, you know, the bun, the meat, and then the bun. So we chose like a non-acronym for that particular icon there.
Well, it depends on if the buttons are vertical or horizontal, right? It's the more button, but I think you get the same result whether they're horizontal. Back to the ISAO versus ISAC, right? Can you explain the difference in those?
So there are actually types of organizations. So there's ISAOs, ISACs, and CERTs. And generally speaking, they're information sharing organizations. So for example, each major industry, let's say health, finance, retail, you know, military installations, all those type of things, can have their own sharing organization. And then typically the parent, the ISAC, or the main ISAC for that particular organization, will have many member organizations underneath them. And what they do is they allow information to be shared and disseminated throughout that entire community. So if you imagine the past, maybe one entity received this threat information and was trying to act on it. Now, all the entities in that space can receive the information and act on it, right? So instead of being secular in understanding that something negative could be happening, everyone can understand it and can try to prevent that from occurring in their own environment. So you're basically democratizing the sharing of that threat intelligence, allowing many more organizations to be safer and to have that knowledge they can, you know, sort of orchestrate what needs to happen to mitigate those potential issues in their environment. So it's really all about sharing, safety, analysis, collaboration, which again, you know, next step of security, right? Think about in the years past, singular, protect device, protect asset. Now it's about sharing, collaboration, you know, networking for the greater good.
Yeah, if I was like a healthcare technology company, I definitely see value in that. You know, what do I need to watch out for? What are these other hospital systems seeing? Like, you definitely want to join an ecosystem. There's value in that.
I think that's the case for anything, right? If you look about, you know, I'm sure even on the recruiting side, you probably are part of different groups that are made up of fellow recruiters, you know, sharing tips, practices, things you're learning, white papers. Going alone, I think, is not necessarily the best way these days, right? Being able to share and lean on people and have open conversations, hopefully in a trusting environment, will allow everyone to grow. You're going to share something someone else doesn't know. They're going to share something that you don't know. Maybe you open up your ideas to something you didn't understand. Same with something else. You know, the whole sharing is caring, right? They taught you in kindergarten that. We should probably take a look at that again as an adult.
Mama told me, man, I got to share my toys.
Just not the Kit Kats. Those are mine.
If you give me half the Kit Kat, then maybe I'll return the favor in the future. So you're investing in the pay it forward reciprocity game there. So yeah.
Half a Kit Kat now for like a full Snickers bar later. Is that what you're trying to say?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Nice. Now you're speaking my 4-year-old's language right now. As a father, right? I don't like to waste food, right? I'm the cleanup crew. So whatever they leave behind, I can't let it go to waste. I got to eat it.
There's no shame in that. I mean, you paid for it. It's good food. If you're still hungry, I mean, you know, it's there.
Well, as someone who is in operational efficiency, that would be very inefficient to waste food.
I agree. I've definitely had the conversation about saving, reusing, you know, using the other side of the paper. It's a challenge when they're young, but I think you have to kind of bring in that process part early on, you know, get them exposed to it.
Where do you stand on leftovers in the fridge?
Oh, that's a fighting topic. That can make a lot of people upset with the answer there.
Well, so my wife, she'll only eat leftovers if they're only one day old. My tolerance goes much longer. I just end up being a leftover king.
I mean, certainly if there's any kind of like discoloration, makes me like, that's a no, right? So if you see anything, that's a definite. As for a time thing, I mean, like, you know, I think more than a day. I mean, a day is like, if you're going to only wait it for a day, you might as well just finish it on the first meal. You know what I'm saying? And why bother dirty the dish? Now you're wasting the water. You have sustainability issues. You have to put a dishwasher thing. It's so much more work. I think you can have a longer period of safety there.
Well, I asked one time, it was a restaurant, and I ordered chili, and I was like, hey, just curious, how often do you have to, you know, if you make chili in batches, how often do you have to throw away the old chili and make a new batch? I'm like, oh, it's good for 7 days. I'm like, 7 days? So that's a stretch for me. I'm like, 3 days, that fourth day, I'm a little wishy-washy on it. 5 days is in the trash.
I mean, you know, if it's in your house and it was a controlled kind of environment and it still looked fine, I mean, that's a different question. But like for a restaurant, if you're paying money for it, like I think 7 days is, that's a little bit of a gamble there.
Yeah, yeah.
If you're getting 7-day-old chili, I think I kind of want a discount on the meal at that point.
You know, I know, it should be right?
The same price, you know?
Exactly. Yeah, the fresh chili is full price. 7-day-old chili. Half off, right? That makes perfect sense to me. So
I think it's 10% per day, so it's, you know, 70% off.
Okay, well, when are you starting your restaurant, your chili kitchen? I'll come eat there.
it wouldn't be chili, but that would be fun.
So let's talk about the job market, because I get to see a lot of interesting interactions with candidates about, you know, everybody's on the market basically. So I just started my own agency, right? It's called Hyperdrive Recruiting. And what I was trying to do is go through everyone in my network and reach out and make the announcements, right? Spread the word phase. I had like 4,000 phone numbers in my phone and trying to text everybody. So I finally finished all that up yesterday. After all that, I mean, I basically have one job order and like hundreds of candidates that are like, actually, I'm looking for a job. The market just seems to be, it's crazy right now. What's your take on what's going on?
Only because you started with this earlier on, I have to say you probably would have had more orders if they were blue bubbles, not green. I'm going to have to go back to the AI topic on this one. It's interesting. I think there's a lot of folks out there who are looking for a change. When you go to events and you're having conversations, everyone's hanging up some shingle about, hey, you know, what's going on out there? I want to be informed. You know, we have, I think, the stage of creative titling. That's out there. I think I saw a little kind of graphic the other day online about, you know, I used to be called X, but now I'm like, you know, the master of wizardry for, you know, whatever. Trying to uncover the truth about what is an individual is harder these days. You know, what did you do? What kind of impact did you have? What kind of results did you obtain? I think that the challenges are stacking up on both sides of the fence, both for those who are looking for positions. I think it's harder for them to find their matches. And also for the entity that is hiring, I think it's harder to understand, you know, is this person a good fit? Are they going to work out well in our environment? Or are our expectations aligned at this stage? And I say that after interviewing a lot of folks, right? I've interviewed hundreds and hundreds of folks for this company and in others. So I've had a lot of these conversations. And I think that's something where, yes, you could say AI will help you in certain cases, but I think you put a person to a person in the conversation, a certain person to at least the candidate in the conversation, you're going to get a whole lot more out to understand if that person is great for the company. That's a time intensive task, right? You have to put some love into it, put some care into it. But I think if you do that, back to kind of like the seed of growing a team, growing a company, you will have just multiples of more positive results and return on that investment of time. But I agree with you. I think it's a crazy market. I think there's lots of folks that are looking. I think that the matching is a challenge. I think that we're kind of at a lack of technology at the moment to truly understand, you know, what is open and who is looking and how you kind of move them together, right? You know, we've kind of consolidated on LinkedIn, but it's still very hard, I think, to make those matches. It's almost like we need to have a superset application that kind of gets integrated to these toolings that kind of like you fill out, and then that does some kind of pre-sorting. But when you're seeing JDs out there, we've all done it, right? It's like a kitchen sink. And I want the person to be an astronaut, a biochemist, and I also want them to have 2 Nobel Prizes, but they should also be good at changing the K-cups in the coffee machine. It's really hard to kind of make that happen.
It is. I was in a discussion and back to AI, but one day it's theorized that instead of interviewing for a job, you'll basically spend a week with the AI bot that's trying to evaluate you as a human. And it's going to do all kinds of things, right? You'll play games with it. You'll watch videos with it. It'll watch you, you know, produce whatever, your Excel work or your code. It will throw challenges at you, you know, and you'll spend 3 to 5 days actually just hanging out with this AI. And, you know, it can be fun, right? It's not just like sitting there drilling you with questions, but it's watching what you react to as far as like funny videos online. It's watching your reaction to news headlines and what you find offensive and all this stuff, right? And then at the end of this AI interview, it'll produce a 75-page, 100-page document about you and what you're capable of, strengths, weaknesses, and give you a score. And then companies could basically use that score and all the attributes, all the data points that it got from that, and then match you to jobs at their company.
Okay, well, let's walk down that road for a second.
Okay.
We have the data privacy concern of watching everything you're doing that's not work-related for several days, right? So that's a huge question there, right? I mean, you're basically giving them carte blanche access to your entire screen at that point, right? It's a record of everything you're doing. I'm assuming you're targeting, you know, eye movements and everything, looking at different aspects on the screen. Like, this is a whole lot of questions if that would even be passed from a legal point of view. The other part is, let's say, assuming society got to that point and that was actually an approved metric, you know, how do you apologize for your sins? You know, what if you, for example, got a bad score the first time? Does that mean you're not qualified for anything forever because you maybe you were tired, or maybe you didn't respond to the right things, or maybe the news cycle that month was one where nothing came up to actually elicit a appropriate response? So, you know, I guess if you're being more technical on it, you know, to grade people on the subset of data that happened to cross their screen at random over the course of a period of time, and then kind of stake their life's career on that is a challenge because a subset of data is going to be different for every single person. Now, if you sent the same subset of data to every single person, and then your judgment based on that, that would be a little bit better, I think. But then you'd have to have a lot of data and scientific evidence that that is the right subset of information. So the same way you take like 360-degree surveys or PCMs or other things to understand, you know, who you are, how you integrate, how you collaborate with others, how others collaborate with you, I think you'd have to have a lot more science behind it, I guess, to prove if that is a valid methodology.
Yeah, I'm sure there's companies that are trying to make that right now. And the one that will win is the one that has the most tried and true, you know, data. Whoever they recommend as a good match for whatever the role is, if they have a track record of success, that platform will become the de facto standard, right? But yeah, so we're in the future here. We're way in the future. I don't want to.
I've got a lot of privacy concerns when you're saying recording your entire screen for a few days. That's a lot of questions there.
Well, let's just say it comes in waves, like sessions, like an hour or two at a time. But I love that you played devil's advocate there and probably going to be thinking about this for a while. So I was looking at Cyware's website, right? I visited the open positions page. I saw you had 8 openings in the U.S. You got 8 openings in India. Offshoring and nearshoring is a hot topic lately. It seems to be a lot of companies that are, you know, transitioning roles more nearshore or offshore as opposed to hiring in the States because it's cheaper and maybe employees are a little more productive and they complain less. But why do you think so many companies are deciding to hire elsewhere instead of the U.S.?
You know, I think we're all trying to get a lot done in a short period of time, right? So if you look at, you know, your 24 hours a day, if you can pack more within that time frame and potentially at a lower cost, that does technically get you to move ahead a little faster. You get to move that progress goal, you know, a little bit more each and every day. So I think it's all about optimization. You know, same way you might optimize your internal processes or your internal, you know, cadence of communication. You can find ways to do more work in a short period of time or for less money. I think all companies are naturally going to head in that direction, simply just from a fact of needing to save money and get things done. Now, where I see some complications could be, you know, how does that work with your team, right? Are there any language complications? Can we get past that? Are there any time zone or technical complications? Are there any kind of security complications? Are you allowed to use third-party firms or consultants with your clients? Is that contractually permitted according to the agreements that you have in place? Will there be additional security obligations that might be oppressive for a third-party agency to assist you with, right? So how does that work? So I think it's not going to be a generic yes for everybody, but I think it's going to be something where the leadership would look at it and understand, hey, is this going to be more positive than negative? Is there a way to make this work in my entity? Is there a way that it could be an extension of the team that integrates well? And do I have a way to manage it? You know, I've seen folks maybe be attracted to that and think that, oh, I just hired 10 folks in XYZ country. That's great. But that's still 10 folks. Who's going to manage those folks, right? Do you have a way to share the data back and forth? Do you have a way to bring them onto your systems to share the same knowledge base, your same Jira system, your same whatever you happen to be using? You have to think about the life cycle of that relationship, not just a purchase and let it go. How are we going to manage that in your company? That's back to our operations. You know, we're going to look at it not just from this one little aspect now that makes us feel happy, but how do we manage the entire life around this activity to make the business be successful, right? Our horse in the game isn't just operations. Our horse in the game is make business successful. Whether that means focusing more on sales or ops or finance or marketing or whatever it happens to be, our North Star is business success
and profitability, right? Everybody's cost cutting right now because everything's so expensive. So, you know, hiring somewhere else it helps. All right, we'll change the subject. So I noticed you were a board member, I think, of the SIM, Society for Information Management. And yep. I just joined another organization called NC Tech. Oh. And maybe they're like kind of similar. Can you tell us about SIM and what are the benefits of being a member?
Yeah, certainly. And you could technically be a member of both. They are different. So that's a fair thing there. So SIM is the Society for Information Managers. It's a nonprofit organization. It's actually been around since the 60s. So it's really, really mature. There are chapters in pretty much all major cities across the United States. It's a United States organization. And it's for senior IT leaders. So there is an application process. There are certain things that we ask about, you know, your management responsibility, type of budget being held, type of work exposure and experience. Then the actual activities themselves is that the community, the chapters do run year long. There are things that change depending on what city you're in, but typically there's dinners with presentations. People come in, speakers with great topics or lessons learned or activities they've done. Sometimes authors will come in. There are certain large conferences throughout the year that you can go into to understand specific topics. Maybe there's a cybersecurity focus. Maybe there's an AI focus. There's general networking and happy hours and events. Also, you get to reach out to all other members that are in different chapters, right? So it's not just your chapter where you are today. All the chapters are technically fair game to communicate with and collaborate and to have that exposure. And there's other benefits too.
Nice. Is cybersecurity a hot topic in a lot of those conversations now, at least a lot of the keynotes and a lot of the meetings?
It is actually. We've had one or two conferences that were focused on cybersecurity, a lot of vendors, a lot of conversation. So it's certainly one of the hot ones there. Cybersecurity, AI, transformation efforts, those are always nice and spicy.
Oh, yeah, very right now. So you've got a computer science degree and from Rutgers. So, and you also have an MBA. And he spent the early part of your career as an associate at companies like AT&T and IBM, and you worked your way up to enterprise architect. But then you founded a renewable energy company called Ekamin Solar, and this was like 2011, 2019. And it looked like you were selling like residential commercial solar in New York and New Jersey. What made you decide to go that direction? And then what made you decide to pivot back into tech?
It goes back to operations and folks like us just doing lots of things. So I was in tech for a while, obviously, you know, really hands deep, AT&T, IBM, you know, enterprise architecture, massive workflow ordering management systems, business intelligence systems. We were setting up data centers, high availability, you know, the kind of stuff where if you got a call at 3 a.m, like, you're on a bridge solving that. You know, it's very critical things. The renewable energy part was very interesting. And the aspect there was that the ability to attack a project that would be really great for the world. I mean, obviously, there's an environmental aspect, which is very nice. You're doing good work is what the theory is. There's also a whole lot of technology in it. So some might look at it and say, oh, at the end of the day, you have folks, you know, installing something, right? It's sales and service. Well, yeah, it is sales and service. But the amount of paperwork, automation, back and forth, contractual obligations, you know, marketing, call centers, you know, all those business aspects are very hard in that industry because every single town does something differently. So, you know, we were in New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania, all in. It's probably like 800 and something towns that we kind of worked in across that area. Everyone had different rules, different processes, different requirements, different MMPs. So you really had to build systems around all of this to essentially allow the work to get done. So heavy Salesforce architecture, collaboration, moving things together. But the industry was changing. After a number of years, you know, things were starting to settle out in different directions. And as most things, you know, we changed. So it headed back to a pure technology play.
I wonder, right, if there may be an opportunity like that again, because the power generation needs to support AI. The NVIDIA chips need 7 times more power. And you know, there's a bunch of data center projects going on right now. So it makes you wonder if every data center might need this massive solar farm just to support the energy demands. So who knows? There could be an opportunity to get back in that industry at some point. So yeah, maybe one day.
Yeah, it's funny. Actually, someone actually sent me that, I think the same article you're referencing the other day about the AI and the power needs, which we all knew. And I think most data centers, even with or without AI, I think these days have come around to know solar is a good plus to it, right? You have all the major corporations trying to, you know, lower their carbon counts and everything. I think it's inevitable. I think the knowledge is there. I think certainly in the US, though, there's still a lot of paperwork that has to be done to complete this. There's lots of financing. COVID obviously created a financial challenge for folks to kind of move forward certain installations and, you know, entities. I think it's very, very positive, but I think certainly there's probably still a lot more headroom that industry can go.
I know China is producing the amount of energy or the new energy production resources that we produce in a year. They're doing that in 1 week. It's crazy. So we'll see what happens. Let's talk about operations. And I was listening to one of your other podcasts and it was interesting because one way to be really efficient is to make your company's information really accessible to everyone there. Where do you go to find information and is it up to date and current? So every company may benefit from hiring a role that's considered to be the knowledge-based curator to make sure that all the information is up to date in the right place, easily accessible. And it's like a job within itself. How do you recommend companies go about doing that?
You know, honestly, I think it's a hard one. It's not easy. I can't say, you know, I know anyone who has it perfect. I think the sooner, I mean, I'm talking about, you know, day one, open the door soon, you can start knowledge curation, start it, right? Because the more you move knowledge out of some kind of common platform and into the heads of humans, again, it's you have this tribal knowledge challenge. You have roles which are more risky. You have power struggles that can occur. You have a high risk if someone is ill or out for a little bit. You know, the knowledge in the company on how to operate the company has to be extracted from the individuals, not to minimize their efforts, but so the company can keep on running and that people can grow. You know, if Nancy's the only person who knows how to do these activities, right? How can Nancy grow? How can she become something bigger? How can she go on to that next level if no one else can take her spot? So I think moving from a recognition that this isn't a reduction in a person's capabilities or their future potential, it's more of a, you know, I want this company to run long term. I think that mental shift is the first part. Then the question is, well, how do we unify on tooling, right? I'm not sure there's really one perfect tooling out there, but we put information in so many systems. You have your Slack, your email, your Atlassian systems, you have your CRMs, you know, where does information live and what do you count as that gold standard? There's got to be MMPs around that process. Also has to be easy. If you make it too arduous, no one's going to do it, right? You can have the best application in the world. If it's too arduous, humans aren't going to put stuff into it. So you really got to give that some thought on what's appropriate for your size of organization, for where you're headed, and for the type of content that you have to store.
It's one of the most common complaints that I hear from the development community whenever they land at a new job. And they're like, man, there's no documentation here. Like, I don't know how any of this stuff's put together. It's like, it's crazy how poor a job companies do at this knowledge base curation and documentation for new people.
Yeah, I'll share a little secret here. So that was one of my favorite interview questions I would ask a developer. And the question was, you just came into a company, would you rather inherit a body of code with absolutely no comments or inherit a body of code with potentially incorrect comments?
Probably no comments. I wouldn't want to be, you know, I don't want misinformation. I'd rather have no information than misinformation. What's the right answer?
I'll say this, there's no right answer, but the thought process by which an individual answers a question is the actual test to understand why they're going one way or the other. And if they're really trying to weigh the conversation, that will allow me to understand their experience in kind of dealing with complex code bases.
I love that. Are there any other like really intriguing interview questions that you like to ask that are kind of generic like that?
I think going off the script is really key, right? There's no point in reading down the resume. I want to understand how they act in situations as well, right? So if it's a high pressure role, I want examples of high pressure activities that have been performed. I want to understand if they could play good cop, bad cop in certain roles. You really need to, I think, line the questions up with the type of environment they're going to be in. I think you want to also give them an opportunity to share things that have nothing to do with the role, to kind of just understand, you know, the working relationship. So what would you consider to be a great management style? Or what would you consider to be the way that, you know, you would deal with an employee who wasn't performing to the level of expectation and you are the manager? Having them answer those more, you know, challenging questions, I think, is certainly very fruitful.
No doubt. Yeah, behavioral questions. They're the hardest ones to master and the hardest ones for candidates to answer, because the moment they start talking about this generic way they would handle it versus mm-hmm. a story about a way that they did handle it once upon a time, that's where everybody goes wrong. You know, you can't be generic. You got to tell the story about something that actually happened. That's the best way.
Yeah, you got to show the impact.
Yeah, exactly. Back to operations here. How does your process improvement and like operational efficiency mindset impact your personal life, right? Do you have any daily routines, any hacks?
Calendaring is key. You cannot let your calendar own you. That's a really bad thing. So get your calendar in order, sit down, spend an hour right now, find all the holidays that you care about in your life, block them. Perpetually for life, recurring holidays, wife, kids, family, birthdays, I mean, special events, anniversaries, block them going forward. Halloween, block it going forward. All the things that could upset you in the future, block it going forward. Calendly, great tool. I'm sure I know there's others. I happen to use that one. You know, set up as many types of events as you want, structure them, you know, urgent meetings, later meetings, current meetings, you know, 15 minutes, 30, 45, 60, in-person, not in-person, buffers, not buffers. Just understand all the ways that you collaborate with others in your life and just automate it. Put it out there. It's like hiring an EA. Another tool, Reclaim.ai, really great tool. I know it works with Google. I don't know if it works with Microsoft at this time, but essentially it could merge multiple calendars together and do kind of like bi-directional syncing, but also with conditionality. So you can find a way where, yes, you have your work calendar here and your personal calendar there, but you are only one person, right? Like your body can only exist in one place at a time. We haven't mastered, you know, the multiverse yet. I guess Tony did, but you know, we haven't kind of figured it out. So you can do that. You know, you can show things the way you want to have them situated in each calendar. You'd be very powerful, I think, with that too. You also have a more of a security stance. So let's say we have a lot of applications these days that want to book things for you. They want to know what is your free busy time. Don't give them a regular calendar. There's no reason these applications need access to your personal Gmail calendar. Create a separate Gmail account. Make that just have one busy calendar, shove in your information to that calendar, but only as busy, don't put any content, and give access to that dummy account to the other applications. Everyone's happy, everyone's solved, and you've reduced your exposure of an incident.
Great advice. Yeah, I'm a big fan of the calendar booking links and like time blocking. Yeah, you know, I'm always trying to talk to my wife like, hey, what's going on this week? Like, do I need to be available for such and such? And I'm like, okay, well, let me block my calendar. Because if you do use a calendar booking link, you have to be very intentional about what's open and available to be booked. But yeah, I've got like six different links, right? So depending on, you know, you want a phone call, you want a video call, booking podcast now with a calendar booking link. And yeah, it's like calendar management becomes its own life hack.
Don't have a shared calendar with your wife, so you can kind of just see the events pop up and then kind of book them elsewhere?
I'm absolutely going to have to look up this app you just mentioned, Reclaim AI, because I've been trying to figure out how to do that. That could be the secret sauce. Is there a fee associated or is this a free app?
There is a fee. I do have a referral code, but it is a fee, but I think it's accommodating.
Joe's into affiliate marketing here.
Trying to expand. The second one would be, I think, email. Now, email is a very sensitive subject, right? You can spend hours on this one. I believe your email inbox needs to be as empty as possible. I think the larger it is, whether you lie to yourself or not, it creates a headache, right? It's a mental frustration of, did I actually accomplish what I need to accomplish? Did I get back to the right people? Am I letting someone down? I like to keep that as thin as possible. You know, use your folders these days, push them out somewhere else. Even nowadays, you don't have to be as specific with folders in your mail system, right? Search is so good. Just stick it somewhere that's not your inbox. So you right. understand, like, if I have 20 emails in my inbox, I can manage it. If I have 20,000 in my inbox, how do I really know what's important? You know, yes, you can say unread, read, but it's really challenging, I think, to do that.
So in recruiting, there's a term called B time. So okay. Something comes in, right? It's not A time. This is not like normal business hours type of task here. This is B time. Well, I rebranded that. Now I call it TV time because this is the stuff that I do. You know, when my kids go to bed, here I am watching TV. Maybe I got my laptop out or I just got my phone. Then I go into my TV time folder. All right, what do I got here? What do I need to do? So create yourself a TV time folder and put the non-urgent task in there. And like you said, keep your inbox cleaned up for sure. I'm a big fan of that.
Or even move your inbox. If you have to do something from your inbox, move that into a task in your task manager program and then archive that email so you have it clear. Otherwise, technically, every time you go back to your inbox, your context switching for no reason. You're reading that message, even if it's for a few seconds, and then you're mentally saying, oh, I don't need to worry about this again. But why do you have to spend that time? Why that mental frustration? If you know that I don't need to worry about this for a week, stick that in your task management program, schedule it out, and now you physically don't have to look at it again for a week. You physically don't have to have that mental frustration or that context switching.
You're right. Yeah, every time you go to your inbox, you see this long list. You're like, you'll constantly sit there and click on them and be like, okay, what's this one? What's this one? What's this one? What's this one? The more you can categorize and bucketize them, the better. Good advice there.
And if you're in a work environment, filters. You know, you might be on a lot of lists that you may not need to be on, or you need to be vaguely aware of. I must have 40 or 50 filters on one of my Gmail accounts, right? It's very useful. You send things out. Then instead of looking at things that aren't really critical every day, maybe look once a week. So you've maximized your time. You can maybe do that when you're in other activities or whatever. It's just trying to little hacks to kind of save you time that doesn't derive major value. Hopefully the AI eventually does that for us. But till then, email hacks.
We shall see. Yeah. Good advice. I love it, man. I'm an operational efficiency nerd myself, but maybe that's what makes a pretty good recruiter is people who can organize and operate efficiently to begin with. So maybe that's a piece of the puzzle here. Is there anything else that you want to chat about? I've kind of got through all my questions.
You started with aliens. I wasn't sure where we're going after that. But I think you hit a lot. I mean, I guess you have all the stuff behind you too. So I guess now it makes sense. We went over a lot of topics. I think I might say just in closing, operations is a very interesting area for people. I think there's a lot of opportunity. I think that we're now in a position with the amount of content that is out there that many more people can get into that type of industry. They can learn things, they can explore. There's lots of great communities to share details. You know, nowadays, people who want something, the only thing assuming they have an internet connection, the only thing stopping them is really just kind of searching for it, right? Just to find information, reach out, have conversations. It's all there for the taking.
How can folks find you and what should they try to connect with you about?
At the moment, LinkedIn is the platform of choice. So that is where I have all of my things. So, you know, feel free to reach out to me there. Contact me for saying hi, you know, maybe commenting on this, you know, love the podcast we have here. Also for any kind of advisory stuff, go to market operation related, you know, happy to have conversations on how perhaps, you know, help scale your business, answer your questions and get those complex things solved.
Awesome. Well, it's been fun, Joe. I've enjoyed it, man. You've been a great guest and thank you for coming on.
Thank you very much, Blake. Terrific round of very interesting questions. So I appreciate the diversity.
You're very welcome.